The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, Episode 82. Today, the Amateur Traveler goes to Turkey.
I got my bags packed on a roll. I'm heading out there, and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Oh, no.
15-hour flight, oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Sorry for not getting a show out last week, but I'm afraid at that time my voice sounded like this. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. And while that was a great improvement on the few days before then, I didn't think you'd want to listen to that for very long. The proud winner of an Amateur Traveler mug in the February travel contest was Roger, who entered a review at iTunes, then sent me an email. In Roger's email, he said, "We typically take one big trip per year. This last year was Niagara Falls and surrounding areas to visit family. The year before was renting a camper and touring inland Alaska. And the year before that was the Northeast. My kids, the oldest being 17 and the youngest 12, have been to 37 states. We are missing the Southeast. The only international travel has been to Great Britain. We did a whirlwind tour. Sounds like our travel styles are the same. I always promise my wife that she can rest when we get home. Anyway, thanks for sharing your love of travel with us. Hope I win a mug to use at work." And you have. And speaking of how many places people have gone, I think I've only been to 36 states last I counted. That's not counting any state that I've only been in the airport for. But in a similar vein, there's a site called mosttraveledpeople.com. And at that site, it says that at age 70, Nancy Dockery of Beverly Hills has visited 610, or 91%, of the 673 countries, territories, autonomous regions, enclaves, geographically separated island groups, and major states and provinces of the world. Based on this, she claims to be the world's most traveled person. And if you have traveled to that many countries, or in the top 10 there, you can go and enter your site at mosttraveledpeople.com. And in the final news story, an article came out in USA Today from Reuters. France keeps crown as the top tourist destination. This seems a bit premature, as it appears that the numbers from the UN World Trade Organization haven't come out yet, but it's very likely that France will be, again, the top destination, because last year it had 70, or in the year of 2005, rather, it had 76 million foreign tourists versus the closest runner-up, which was Spain, at 55.6 million. Rounding out the top 10 are the United States, China, Italy, the United Kingdom, Mexico, Germany, Turkey, the subject of this week's show, and Austria. This show, and very likely the next show, will deal with a recent trip to Turkey. I've had a lot of people ask me about my choice of destinations, and there was a moment when I was in eastern Turkey, in the city of Gaziantep, driving in the dark on a dusty road with a Turkish family who were speaking 95% of the time in Turkish. I was about 30 miles from the Syrian border. I got as close as 200 miles to the Iraqi border, and I recall thinking, and how exactly did I get here? So let me back up a bit to October of 2003. My wife got a call where she works at the church across from a local high school that they had a Turkish exchange student who was looking for a new host family. For reasons not his fault, it wasn't working out with the host family, and so they were looking for someone to take care of this Turkish exchange student, and they might have to send him home if he couldn't find anything. And that to us seemed like that would be just wrong, and so we became the host family for the rest of the school year for a young Turkish lad, 18 years old, by the name of Yavuz, who ended up going to high school with my two children, who were sophomore and freshman at that time. And as you can imagine, we got fairly attached to him, and as he wanted us to come visit him, I actually started studying Turkish that year, but it didn't work out for us to come and visit him at that point. Or perhaps we were just too afraid to go to that region of the world, would be more accurate, and really didn't decide to go to Turkey until I was looking at places to go this February to use up some vacation time before I would lose it. And my wife chose not to go with me because she didn't have the extra vacation time, was still a little leery of the region. But I brushed up a little on what little Turkish I knew and booked airfare and headed to Turkey. This is probably a good point to say something about Turkish hospitality, or at least my experience with it. One of the things that delayed us in going to Turkey was the expectation in terms of how much time we would have there, because Yavuz wanted us to come see his family and stay for a week. Well, we only have so much vacation time, but it was necessary, he said, for us to be feted, to have parties that all the different neighbors would want to welcome us. And that was one of the problems, was if we were going to Turkey, we actually wanted to see Turkey. And so it became a little bit of a problem in terms of logistics. And that probably should have set some expectations in my head in terms of what to expect on this trip in terms of hospitality. But I have to say that I wasn't prepared. The first thing we ran into is we flew into Istanbul and spent a few days in Istanbul, and I'll probably cover that in the next show. Istanbul was a real highlight of the trip for me, and I'll talk about some of that experiences. And then I needed to get way over to eastern Turkey, and so I looked at driving, but it's actually a larger country than I was thinking, and so it was really only going to work well to fly, given that I only had about 7 to 10 days. And so I looked at some of the low-cost carriers like Owner Air, Atlas Jet, and Sun Express, and I'll put some links for some of the best Turkey travel planning sites that I found. But when I went to some of these sites, I found that the English engine on certain days wasn't working properly, and so Yavuz helped me get my flights using the Turkish version of the interface on the web. And so when I went to say, well, how much do I owe you for the hotel rooms or for the flights around Turkey, I offended his father, who was offended that I would even offer to pay. Of course, for me, to not offer to pay would be an offense in the U.S. And so very quickly it became established that they were intending for me to be their guest and them to treat, which I'd have to say made me uneasy. It was difficult to accept all the hospitality. I was also told, take another suitcase. Well, I actually like to travel light, and so I like to take a carry-on suitcase. And so I brought a larger suitcase that was too large for carry-on, and when I got there, I found out the reason why Yavuz really hadn't exaggerated. They had numerous gifts that they wanted me to bring back to my family. Part of the thing was that when he had come over as an exchange student, he had brought numerous gifts to his host family. Well, we were actually his third host family, as it turns out. And so by the time he got to us, he felt bad that he didn't have more gifts. Well, it didn't really matter to us. So we enjoyed our time with him, and so it wasn't that important to us. But I think it was very important to them. And so I was sent back with metalwork pots, copper pots, and tin pots and tablecloths and pairs of shoes for me and slippers for my father and shoes for my son and necklaces for my daughter and necklaces and earrings for my wife and a shawl that his mother had made, and just really they weren't exaggerating, a suitcase full of gifts that they wanted me to take back. I was sent back with 2 boxes of baklava. I was sent back with the makings for salep, which I'll get to eventually, and numerous other things. So there was just this overwhelming generosity that was frankly difficult for me to accept. It sort of went against my nature that to just say thank you and to accept all this. It seemed just way too much for me. But Yavuz had warned me that his father, when he would talk about me going to his friends, would say, my brother is coming. And so really, I wasn't being treated as guest, I was being treated as family. And so now I have extended family in Turkey. And that's how I found myself, riding in the dark, with this family that I could not communicate well with. I had studied some Turkish before I went. I speak predominantly tourist Turkish, so I can say İngilizce konuşuyor musunuz? Do you speak English? Or İki kişilik masa lütfen, table for two please. Or Temiz ve ucuz otel nerede? Is there a clean and cheap hotel near here? Or even the ever popular Olanlar ve kadınlar dans ediyorlar. The young men and women are dancing. But pretty much after that, other than being able to name the items on the breakfast table, I'm out of Turkish. And so that was a lot of the conversations we had, naming the items on the breakfast table and then me saying teşekkürler, which means thank you. I'll put some links to both the book and CD series that I used for studying Turkish, which I just wish I'd had enough advance warning for this trip that I would have gotten further into the book than two or three chapters. And then also for a podcast for learning Turkish. It's an enhanced podcast, as this one is. And so while this podcast includes pictures, the Learning Turkish with Sinan podcast includes the phrases, so you can see what the phrases you're being taught. So, Eastern Turkey. The region that I was in, Gaziantep in particular, is not necessarily the center of the tourist trade in Turkey. In fact, there are several areas that are more popular, and probably the three most popular areas in Turkey are obviously Istanbul, Cappadocia, and the Ephesus area near Izmir. And I got to two of those three. I did not get to the Cappadocia area, but as you go to Gaziantep, it doesn't mean that there aren't things to see there. Gaziantep itself is a major industrial area and is the center for carpet production in Turkey and is also known for its pistachios and also for baklava. The first day we were there, we headed out to the east to the city of Şanlıurfa. As you go between Gaziantep and Şanlıurfa, it is a very barren area with a lot of rocks and dust and such with number of orchards for pistachios and olives, and with a fair amount of sheep grazing also, and then suddenly go to Şanlıurfa, and it itself is another major town. Most of the Turkish people are not living in houses, but are living in apartment complexes at this time, at least by what I was told and what I saw. And I'd say the typical home for a Turkish family is four families per floor and about seven floors for a apartment building. That's typical, give or take a floor or two. And as you get to Şanlıurfa, there is a park-like area surrounding a mosque with a fortress up on the hill. And the story goes, I'm told from the Quran, that this is the home for Abraham. This is what the Muslims believe, and that Abraham at one point is being persecuted by the king in the area, who throws him down into this lake of fire and it turns into fish. And so you'll see this lake filled with fish, and you're not supposed to eat the fish. In fact, you're told that if you eat the fish that they would be poisonous, but people are feeding the fish in this lake. And there's also this mosque nearby where legend has it that Abraham was born, according to the Muslims. And as you're in Şanlıurfa or Urfa, it is a more eastern city. So Istanbul feels very European, and it is defined as European because it's on the other side of the Bosphorus. But as you get out to Gaziantep, it starts to feel a little different. And as you get to Urfa, it felt even more different. And you're at this point in the Kurdish areas of Turkey. And so you start to see more Kurds. You start to see also some more people in Arab garb, or even more women in veils and such, which you don't see as much, certainly don't see as much in Istanbul, and less so in Gaziantep. The market in Şanlıurfa as the market in Gaziantep are both very bustling, very energetic, very interesting places to walk through because they're not aimed at tourists. This is a part of Turkey that is not aimed at tourists. So as we walk through the market in Istanbul, which we'll talk about next week, I'll even play you some of the people who are talking to me in English, and they're ignoring the Turks who are with me and zeroing right in on me to try and sell me a carpet. But by contrast, when we're in the markets in Gaziantep or Şanlıurfa, then they're ignoring me and they're focusing in on the Turks in the party and speaking Turkish, and this is basically where people shop. And because of that, I think I enjoyed the markets here in eastern Turkey even more so than the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul, because you could also see the craftsmen creating things, especially in Gaziantep, even more so than Urfa. You could see the tinkerers out there making their pots and shaping them, and you could see the shoemaker making his handmade leather shoes. In fact, the shoes I brought back are from the fellow who made the shoes for Brad Pitt for the movie Troy. And you could also see, obviously, the spices everywhere, even more so probably than the spice bazaar in Istanbul. And this leads to Turkish food. I love Turkish food. Now, I knew I liked Turkish food before I went, but I also had only one bad meal, I think, in Turkey, and that's when I went someplace that was trying to do American food, and they made fajitas, and that was not so good. But the Turkish food tends to be very flavorful. Of course, you have the spices everywhere. It's one of the only places I've been where, for instance, you'd find something like salt and pepper on the table, but you might also find thyme or something like that. You might find a pomegranate sauce, which I really like. The food would tend to be very pretty, very good presentation, too. A lot of tomatoes and cucumbers and such, as a lot of Mediterranean foods, olives certainly, but very appealing in terms of how it looks. And don't, of course, forget all the sweets, the baklava in various shapes, with lots of, in this area, lots of pistachios, so lots of green things, pistachios on this and pistachios on that. And I would have told you that I didn't like pistachios before going on this trip, and I found that that is just not the case. And the other custom that I liked is sitting down sometime in the afternoon, for instance, for a small glass of tea or chai. And it's not a very large thing. It's smaller than you'd have if you were at an English tea house, for instance. But it's only one new Turkish lira, and a new Turkish lira is about 1 lira per 70 cents. The old lira was about 1 million per 70 cents U.S., but they revalued that with the last few years. And so you'd sit there, you'd have the table for an hour, 2 hours, or whatever, and you might just have one or two little glasses of tea, and you'd get up and you'd only spend about 70 cents. And it's just a wonderful, civilized little way to spend the afternoon. And you would see in the markets somebody carrying a tray, and they're carrying the tray from a number of chains, and on this tray you'd find 3 or 4 glasses of tea so that people could have their tea in the afternoon even while they were working in their market stall. The market stalls don't tend to be all that big. They'd probably about 10 feet by 10 feet, most of the different market stalls, and so there's no room for that sort of thing, so someone is bringing them their afternoon tea. On the way out to Şanlıurfa, and I should say it's Şanlıurfa or Urfa, and it's Gaziantep or Antep. They used to have the shorter name, and then in the War for Independence, as they fought to become modern Turkey and fought the Allies, basically, after World War I, who were occupying the country, they got names like Gaziantep, which means heroic Gazi. And so you'll hear people call the cities by both names. On the way out to Urfa, we stopped at the site of Zaugma, and Zaugma is a old Roman settlement here in eastern Turkey, and it was the Roman easternmost city, and so it was used quite often as the base of operations, for instance, in a series of war between Rome and Parthia, which would be in what is now Iran. And so it was the center for a lot of that was going on here in the eastern part of the empire until it was finally sacked by the Parthians in retribution for it being used as a base against them. There's not much left in Zaugma because basically there is a large lake now, because there's a reservoir here to irrigate this land. But what they did is they took many of the Roman mosaics and the sculpture and other artifacts from here and put them in a very small and unassuming but wonderful museum in Gaziantep with some of these amazing mosaics. And this beautiful, both large and small mosaics. There's one particular small mosaic that is associated with Gaziantep, and it is thought to be a portrait of a woman, although some say it's a portrait of Alexander the Great. It's not particularly large, but it's a beautiful mosaic and a good representation of that style. Also within the Gaziantep Museum, you'll see also signet rings from the time and numerous other artifacts, but the mosaics, I think, are what really stand out. And some of the mosaics are entire rooms, and they were floors for rooms. And so one of them, for instance, is the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, and you can even see the three-dimensional effect that they've made out of these small tiles that they've used to create this mosaic. And outside the Gaziantep Museum, you would also see a number of funerary stones or sculptures, and you can see the number of different cultures that have had an impact in this area, because you'll see Roman, you'll see Assyrian, you'll see Greek, and a number of other ancient civilizations represented in the style of art here. And as I said, the other area of Turkey that I got to that was in the Asian side of Turkey, and Turkey is split in Europe and Asia along the Bosphorus that go between the Aegean Sea and the Black Sea. The other region I got to was Izmir, and I went to that area predominantly because I wanted to get to Ephesus and Pamukkale and Hierapolis. And Yavuz came with me, and we left his family in Gaziantep, and he was taking some time before he went back to college. And it was nice to have him along, especially as a driver, because he drove down to Ephesus and then on to Pamukkale and Hierapolis. And from Izmir, that's pretty much a whole day trip, and that's a kind of a long day, especially here in the winter with the shorter days. And the one thing we should say about Turkish driving is it is reminiscent for me of the driving in Rome or the driving in Paris. It can be a little challenging if you're not used to it. The one thing that I found particularly peculiar was the rather fluid use of lanes. And so it wasn't that uncommon, for instance, to be driving down the road, even a major road, and seeing a bus that really couldn't decide which lane it was in for miles at a time. And so there is some of a impatience in Turkish driving. There's certainly a predominant use of the horn in terms of telling people that they're not doing what you think they should be doing. And so it was helpful to have him along driving along this area. So Ephesus is south of Izmir, near the modern Turkish town of Seljuk, and Ephesus is an old Greek colony, and one of the particular reasons that I'm interested in seeing it is, being somebody who's both a student of history as well as a Bible scholar, Ephesus is an area that the early church was particularly strong in, and in fact, the Apostle John would be buried in the Basilica in Seljuk, and there is a home known as Mary's House, which is a small chapel up on the hill above Ephesus, which is held for some time, with some reasonably historic accuracy, to be where Mary, the mother of Jesus, died, because she was cared for by John here in Ephesus. And so Ephesus is also a very large and well-preserved ruin, or well-preserved as ruins go. And the two most notable things in Ephesus that I think most people have seen pictures of, one is the facade for the ancient library, which is this beautiful 2-3-story facade that is made out of marble. The library behind it now being lost, and this being largely reconstructed, but you get a sense of what the scale and majesty of these buildings would be. And then the large amphitheater, the larger of two amphitheaters there, is notable both for how well preserved it is, and then also because it's mentioned in the biblical account in Acts 19 of a riot that breaks out in Ephesus, because Ephesus is the home of one of the seven ancient wonders of the world, or used to be, the Temple of Artemis. And as the Christianity came in, the people who made the little idols that you would take home with you, the tourists, were threatened by the fact that this new faith would decrease their livelihood. And so there's a riot that is mentioned that flows into this large amphitheater, which is still standing here in Ephesus. The other thing about Ephesus is, while Eastern Turkey, I said, was outside of where tourists go, Ephesus is certainly not. In fact, it's a place where people will go off of cruise ships and will do this as a excursion from their cruise ship. And so there are large buses of tourists, and I was trying to figure out how many different languages I was hearing as we were in Ephesus. And I could certainly hear tourists speaking in Italian and German and French and Japanese and Chinese and a number of other languages in traveling in large groups, as well as large groups of school kids who are taking advantage of this as an educational opportunity. But still, for me, Ephesus is a wonderful, the scope of it. You get an idea of that this was a city. And it's interesting, there's one place where you can go and pay a second admission. The admission for many of the places in Turkey is about 10 Turkish lira, so about $7. And in Ephesus, you could pay a second admission and go into a enclosed structure where they were doing, where you can see a larger house that later on is split into multiple different houses. You can see really how literally right on top of one another. Various families lived, especially later on, as the city was started somewhat into decline. With Ephesus being an ancient Greek city, the two things that I enjoyed, one was trying to identify my Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian columns, and the other one was noticing that if you look at the inscriptions in Ephesus, look at the writing and you'll see that it's all capitalization Greek letters and that there's no spaces in between words because that's the way ancient Greek was written. Certainly seems like that was a lot harder to parse, and so congrats to whoever it was who thought to add the space. Made me wish that I had gotten a little further in my study of the Greek language. I got as far as knowing that where my thesaurus is, there my cardia will be also. Izmir to Ephesus is the easy part of that day because the drive there is on a tollway, a very new modern highway, and the tolls are very reasonable, although I should point out that while renting a car was not so expensive and the tolls were very inexpensive, something like 2 Turkish lira, so about $1.40. Gas, you'll find, is going to be very expensive. I think when I did the calculations from lira per liter to dollars per gallon, it was going to end up somewhere in the $6 to $8 a gallon range by the time all was said and done. The road from Seljuk, which is near Ephesus, to Denizli, which is near Hierapolis and Pamukkale, was a much slower road through small towns and cities, and much less of it on the tollway, and took probably 3 hours to get there and another three to four hours to get back to Izmir. But Pamukkale and Hierapolis are a region that is two different things right next to each other. Pamukkale is a series of terraced calcium deposits left over from hot springs, and Hierapolis is an ancient city that was built to take advantage of these hot springs, an ancient Greek city just up the hill from the city of Laodicea, if you've heard of that. As you get there, you park in a common parking lot for the two, and you walk in through Hierapolis, and you actually walk in through the necropolis, or the cemetery of the city, and much of the city is not there anymore, but it's amazing how much of this necropolis, this very large area of crypts, is still there. So it's difficult to tell how many people lived in Hierapolis, but you can certainly tell that a lot of people died in Hierapolis. And as you walk further in, you get to the basilica, and you get to the market, and the Forum, and you get to baths, which you can currently take advantage of the hot springs and go swim in the baths there. And then you get to Pamukkale, and it's this series of pools. And so everybody there, all of the tourists, and there's plenty of tourists from all over, are taking off their shoes and setting them down and walking in and wading into these, at this time of year at least, I would say warm water. They weren't even hot water pools where we were, and that go terraced down the hill here. And people were practically giddy from just the experience of walking through these pools, and I'm not sure exactly why, but it was just interesting, this very surreal landscape, and lots of tourists here, and I found myself to be part of the attraction. Of Korean tourist came to me and handed me his camera. I'm thinking, oh, you want me to take your picture? And so I went to take his picture, and no, he wanted his picture taken with me, and I don't know why, but perhaps a fan of the amateur traveler there from Korea. But so I took my picture with a Korean tourist, and then his friend had to have his picture taken with me. And it's quite possible, because I was the tallest person around, being probably a head taller than the average Turk and certainly than the average Korean. Izmir itself feels certainly European, or almost like American. In one particular mall that we went to, I could see my daughter's favorite shops. But it's a very tourist area. It is at least the downtown portion of Izmir that faces the sea, because Izmir is on a long inlet off of the Aegean Sea, is fairly nondescript as far as architecture goes. There's some lovely monuments there, but the most of the city is along the shore are these, say, 7-8-story tall apartments, with the first floor being shops and restaurants and such. But there's a lovely promenade along the ocean there, or along the sea, the Aegean, and there are a number of cafes. You can go and get your glass of chai, and they will give you a backgammon board if you want to spend some time there. You could also use what I would call a hookah pipe, and there's a different name for it in Turkish, but that escapes me at the time. Or you can get your picture taken. There were some entrepreneurs there that would sell you your picture. They would take your picture with a digital camera, and then they had rigged up battery packs to photo printers and would print out the picture for you and give it to you for only a lira anyway, so it was actually a pretty good deal. So that part of Izmir was a lovely place to just hang out, and there was a fairly young crowd, and Turkish has a fairly young population that was just sort of promenading up and down the coast there on this beautiful day that we were there, past the tugboats and the piers and the various boats coming and going in this lovely seaside town. I think one of the reasons that Yavuz wanted to come with me to Izmir is apparently among Turks, Izmir has the reputation as having the most beautiful women. So that may have had some draw to the young college student. We also took a trip out to the lovely, quiet seaside town of Çeşme, which is out further out this peninsula that goes out from Izmir into the Aegean. And it's just a quiet little town, at least in the wintertime, but still lovely weather this time of year while I was there. As my guidebook for Turkey, I did use the Eyewitness Travel Guide, and that tends to be a favorite of mine because I am a very visual learner, and the Eyewitness Guide is filled with pictures, and as a photographer, and one of the things I want to do is go and take pictures of beautiful places, it's a good guide for me because it gives me an idea of what I'll see in various places. So I'll put a link to that on the show notes also for that guidebook. So that's sort of the middle part of my trip. My trip started and ended in Istanbul, and next week I'll deal with Istanbul, and I really thought I had more to say about Istanbul than the rest of the trip, so I wanted to get through some of the general information in this, like why I went and studying Turkish and those sort of things, and I won't talk about that next week, so this will be a two-part set, and next week we'll focus predominantly then on the European part of Turkey, which it would be mostly Istanbul, and so we'll focus on all the different things to see in Istanbul. So I hope you come back for that, and certainly feel free to subscribe to the show so that you can get it. You can subscribe to it in iTunes, and there are instructions on the site. I did do some updates to the website recently to try and put in an About Me page and some other things to make the site a little better organized, and got rid of some other things that seemed to be getting in the way in terms of making the site a little more busy. In the Internet Resources part of the show, I've mentioned TravelVoyeur.com before as a place where you can see travel videos. This one particular travel video caught my eye. It is a video of a preschooler saying the capitals of the nations of the world, as if you didn't already feel bad enough about your geography prowess.
Europe country capitals, Albania.
Tirana.
Andorra.
Andorra.
Austria.
Vienna.
Belarus.
Minsk.
For those of you who may have found the section that I was talking about, the Apostle Paul in Ephesus, to be interesting, there is a resource for you, and that is an unusual travel resource from Rick Steves done for the Lutheran Church called The Life of the Apostle Paul. So this is not a travelogue so much as a story about Paul, but it takes in, obviously with Rick Steves as the host, various locations where Paul went and shows some of that, and I'll put links to that. It is up on Google Video in the show notes. I heard of the site gomio.com, that's G-O-M-I-O.com, through MySpace and a friend on MySpace who said they first heard about me by a guy staying in one of their hostels in Ireland told them to check out the site. Gomio.com, they said check it out for European festival information, local knowledge, and accommodations for hostelers. Also up on the site is they have an upcoming conference March 24th in Switzerland for anybody interested in looking for budget travel. Another listener of the show is Bruce Smith, and Bruce Smith sent me a site, Bruce Smith's Caribbean Voyage, brucesmithvoyage.com. Check that out to see information about Bruce and how he made a boat and is sailing into the Caribbean. At least a couple people have taken me up on the offer to blog at amateurtraveler.com and write some travel articles for the site that we can all share. If you're interested in doing that, let me know. I can offer you fame, but not fortune at this time, but I would allow you certainly to keep the copyright for the articles, and you would write under your own byline. So if you're interested, drop me an email. I'll be teaching part of a class on podcasting next week at San Jose State University through a fellow podcaster at the local meetup group. And with that, we'll bring the show to a close. As always, I'd look forward to getting your feedback. Either call our comment number, which is area code 206 Mom Love. Put something on the discussion boards at amateurtraveler.com/board, or drop an email at host@amateurtraveler.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Podshow and Limelight.